The affidavits of former clients who implicate you in criminal activity. Who are they?
Somebody named George Edgerly.
Okay. George Edgerly is not a client.
Okay.
George Edgerly. See, as I say, this is going to take some time, and it's like an auditing session, and I'm willing to engage in it, but you're going to have to bear with me because a lot of this covers facts that covered numerous years, and the allegations are contrived and put together in such a fashion that they're ridiculous. George Edgerly is as follows. Sometime in the early or late 1960s, early 1970s, when I was either in law school or at Holy Cross College, he murdered or was indicted for murdering his wife. He is a famous criminal, and there is a book. If you read a book written by F. Lee Bailey, the first case Bailey talks about is George Edgerly. Edgerly was indicted for murdering his wife. Lee Bailey was a young lawyer who had become skilled in the lie detector. And he was brought into the case by an old criminal defense lawyer who wanted to use Bailey's skills in the lie detector. The lawyer either had a heart attack or something happened to him in the middle of the trial. Bailey took over the case. Bailey won the case. And Edgerly was found not guilty. The woman was carved up in little pieces, and one of the big issues was whether it was even Edgerly's wife that was found in this river in the Massachusetts area. Now, years later, after I'd been trying cases for about 4 or 5 years, and I had won some very large and publicized trials around Massachusetts that covered many different issues, there was a famous trial that came up called the Motorgate case. In the Motorgate case, there was about 14 or 15 people indicted, and as a lawyer at that time, I defended white-collar criminals, among other types of cases. I defended white-collar crime. And on that point, I will submit to you that all the church lawyers, or virtually all the church lawyers, have been criminal lawyers, defending, like Earl Cooley now, defending drug dealers, murderers. One of the most reprehensible criminals in Massachusetts was recently represented by Earl Cooley. He's a famous criminal lawyer from Massachusetts, and years ago was a very good lawyer. So back in the early 70s, when I got out of law school, I had a number of famous white-collar. I defended the chairman of the board of a bank that was indicted for embezzling about $8 or $10 million. I defended a variety of well-known, large, very highly publicized cases, and developed a very good reputation in Boston in connection with the trial of lawsuits. When Motorgate developed, it was all over the New York Times, all over the news, all over the United States. And basically what it involved was $33 million in warranty fraud by one of the largest Chevrolet dealerships in the United States, whereby people would come in to have their car fixed. And George Edgerly was the service manager of that dealership. And the warranties would be, if someone came in to have their windshield wipers fixed, he'd put down that they put a new engine in. The warranties would then be submitted to General Motors, and General Motors would pay in the warranty claim. And the money would 4% would go to the service manager, 2% went to the chief executive officer, who was my client, and the net profit of the corporation went to a fellow named Gordon Butler, who was defended by James St. Clair, who defended Richard Nixon. He was the most famous trial lawyer at that point in time in Boston and probably in the East Coast, St. Clair. Now, so as a young trial lawyer, I thought I was in pretty good company with St. Clair because he had the chairman of the board and I had the president and chief executive officer, a fellow named Kimos. So that case, I didn't know this fellow Edgerly from a hole in the wall. What happened was this. General Motors was used to their dealers writing false warranty claims. It was an accepted practice. Everyone did it, and it would take me a long time to explain this to you, but because of the nature of warranty work and the stipulated amount that General Motors would pay. For example, if you had an electrical problem, for those of you, or any of you who are mechanics for General Motors, you would know that they would only allow, say, 1.6 hours to repair the electrical problem. And no matter whether you spent 3 or 4 hours, General Motors would only pay 1.6. So over the years with this system, mechanics got in the habit of falsifying warranty claims. And apparently dealers all over the United States were doing it because of the nature of the system. And it became a prevalent practice. George Edgley began to pump the warranty at General Motors, at this particular dealership, Butler Chevrolet. The warranty claims in a space of 2 or 3 months went from $25,000 a month to $40,000 to $50,000 to $60,000, $70,000 a month. General Motors told Gordon Butler and Kimos, my client, the chief executive officer, just tell Edgley, reduce the warranty claims. Edgley said no. It was a big battle. In fact, if you ever want to get the transcript of this trial, which was the longest sequestered jury trial in the history of Middlesex County in Massachusetts at the time, it lasted over 3 months. In the last 3 weeks, and originally there were like 14, 15 defendants. By the end of the trial, there were only two defendants left, St. Clair's client and my client. Every other defendant made a deal with the government and turned state's evidence against our two, including George Edgley. Now, where did I tell you what happened? Edgley had beaten the murder rap on his wife. He had won a number of other criminal cases. He was a known criminal in Massachusetts, and the DAs were after him. General Motors came in and told Gordon Butler and told my client to tell Edgley, the service manager, to reduce the warranty claim, get him back down into, quote, a livable area. That was a big issue in the case. Because the defense of Kimos and Butler in the case was that everyone wrote warranty. General Motors knew it. Edgley went crazy with these warranty claims, and we told him to reduce them, and he wouldn't because he was getting his 4%. He could no longer control the mechanics because their pay was a percentage of the warranty claims, too. So he could no longer control them. Now, General Motors then sends in a man named Frank Smith. Now, at this point, I don't even know these people. What I'm telling you is happening in the present time of the case, before it ever became a case. Frank Smith is sent in for months to sit from General Motors to sit next to Edgley and look at every claim and tell him to reduce them. Smith was an alcoholic. Edgley was an alcoholic. Edgley simply refused to do it. Now, this, what I'm about to tell you, is so bizarre, it's almost incredible, but this is precisely what happened. One night, Edgley took Smith out in a bar in front of witnesses, pulled a gun out of his pocket, and said, "See this? You're going to get this tonight." They were both completely drunk. Put it back in his pocket. He and one of the other witnesses, a fellow named James Dolson, who worked for Edgley, and Frank Smith then got into the car. They drove out to the Beverly Mud Flats. Dolson stood near the car. Edgley took Smith, walked him down to this mud area, pulled a gun out, and shot him and killed him. The next thing you know, all hell breaks loose. General Motors descends on Butler Chevrolet. Kimos hires, my client, his name is Kimos, hires another lawyer whose name I forget, who begins the defense of Kimos. Edgley hires a lawyer named Pat Piscatelli, a real good, ethical, famous criminal lawyer from Massachusetts, but an ethical one. Butler hires St. Clair. Proceedings go on. The first case that's tried is a larceny case against Edgley and one or two other people, which was the shorter case. Edgley's convicted of larceny. It's the first time the DA has been able to convict him of anything. He subsequently, and I'm going to have to digress again a little bit here, Jimmy Dolson, believes, or strike that, Edgerly believes that Jimmy Dolson, the guy who has seen him kill Smith, has turned state's evidence and is going to testify against him in the Smith murder trial, which has not come up yet. This is going to be incredible to you, but this is exactly what happens. Edgerly gets Dolson drunk. They get a prostitute, and they get with a fellow, another one of their friends called Jackie Shanahan. They take Shanahan, Dolson, and the prostitute to a shack out in the woods. They get Dolson completely drunk, give him drugs. He's lying semi-passed out in a bed. Edgerly comes in and stabs him 4 or 5 times in the stomach. Shanahan comes in and they wrap Edgerly up, and they wrap Dolson up in a sheet, pull him out to the car, and put him in the back seat of a car. The girl is passed out in the next room. They then start to clean the place up and try to rouse the girl. Dolson, meantime, is still alive. This is the fellow you're dealing with, George Edgerly. Dolson is still alive. Crawls out of the car with his gut hanging out and crawls a half a mile to a house. Or no, he first hides under the porch of the shack. Dolson and Edgerly and Shanahan come out of the shack, can't find Dolson, lose their cool, there's blood all over the back seat, and they drive the car into a lake to try to destroy the evidence of the blood in the car. The car only gets halfway submerged. I mean, it's like Amos and Andy. Now, Dolson lives. Next trial, the attempted murder of Jimmy Dolson by George Edgerly. A friend of mine named John Mee in the Middlesex County DA's office tries the case. And even though I'm defending Chemos in the still pending conspiracy trial, they indicted Chemos for conspiracy to write false warranty claims because he was getting 2%, and he was, you know, he should have known what was going on and all that, right? Now, so Edgerly is indicted for the attempted murder of Dolson and the murder of Smith. He's the only one, and for those crimes. Shanahan turns state's evidence. The girl testifies. And I tell John Mee, the prosecutor, who just coincidentally also went to Holy Cross College, that the way to cross-examine Edgerly is to get him up on the witness stand and get him talking. But John goes after him tooth and nail. And Edgerly gets on the witness stand and basically says, I didn't do it. Shanahan did it. So then it's Shanahan's word against Edgerly. And the evidence comes in at the trial, show you how tough it is to get a criminal conviction in any criminal case. The evidence comes in at the trial that the motive for the attempted murder of Dolson was because Dolson saw Edgerly murder Smith. I mean, how much, you know, unbelievable evidence. So the jury knows that Smith's been murdered, that Dolson's a witness. They got Shanahan testifying. The jury comes in, not guilty. Next trial. We'll call the long trial. Longest sequestered jury trial in the history of Middlesex County at that point. All these defendants, the big trial, the big catch-all claim, the conspiracy claim, and most criminal defense lawyers will tell you the easiest case to prove of any criminal case is a conspiracy case, because all you have to prove is that one person told another person, let's go commit a crime. You don't have to prove, you know, the hard facts of larceny or the hard facts of murder, only that you had a conversation and you conspired together, like we're conspiring together now to destroy this church, that you conspired together to do something, all right? So the case goes to trial, and there were some lesser charges. Gordon Butler gets convicted of all 4 or 5 charges eventually. My client gets acquitted of four and convicted of conspiracy, for which he actually served, I think, 6 months or something. He got a 2-year sentence, and he had to serve half that time, then he got time off. He had never had any criminal record before this. But in any event, he did it. He knew. He got his 2%. The jury probably did the right thing, even though throughout the years, for your own edification, Chemos hated Edgley. Edgley hated Chemos, and it was a constant war between them, between the front end of the business, which Chemos ran, and the back end of the business, which Edgley ran. And my defense at the trial was that my client didn't do it. Edgley did it. So if you or the church gets all the transcripts of this 3 months trial, you will see that the whole defense was George did it. Next trial, the murder of Smith. During the cross-examination of all the government witnesses during a long prosecution's case on the Smith murder, Edgley is building up the defense through his then defense counsel, and this is incredibly coincidental, whose name is Harvey Brower, who has since been disbarred and now works for Ingram. Now, during the defense, Edgley is concocting this, you know, this fairy tale that the murder of Smith was done by Butler and Chemos. You know, he hates Butler and Chemos because of the other trial. And because Chemos and Butler ran the biggest cocaine distribution center in the world, and Smith found out about it, and so Chemos had him murdered. It was absurd. It was just bizarre. Now, Edgley calls, as his subpoenas Butler and Chemos, who were then in prison for the conspiracy conviction. And most criminal lawyers will tell, you know, your client just takes the fifth, right? If they're being implicated in anything, they've already been convicted. So the easy way out for criminal defense lawyers when they're dealing with any kind of a problem like this is just tell your client to take the fifth. So what Edgley and Brower intended to have happen was to put Chemos on the witness stand and have him take the Fifth Amendment in front of the jury after he's been showing the jury for these 3 or 4 weeks concocting this crazy story. And he figured as me as counsel for Chemos would just say, Ted, look, just take the fifth, it's ridiculous. You just get yourself out of it. So I tell my client, I said, Ted, look, you know that the whole thing's ridiculous. Just get up there, tell the judge you're not going to take the Fifth Amendment, and you're ready to testify. Which he does. And the transcript will bear me out. Brower and Edgley, and the judge even looks at me, and Judge Bronya looks at me and says, Mr. Flynn, have you instructed, your client was indicted for the warranty fraud and conspiracy, and he's been convicted, and the defense in this case has been that, your client and Gordon Butler are the ones that, not me, are the ones who, I didn't come into the case, incidentally, till a year after the murder, when the case was just about to go to trial. But in any event. And I said, yeah, I've informed the judge, and he wants to testify. So then I go to the prosecutor, because I do not like George Edgley. I go to the prosecutor, and I said, look, you know, Edgley's beat all these cases, and here's the way you handle them. You just heard Chemo say that he's going to testify. Now, Edgley is never going to call him as a witness. So he's going to now back off that and not call him. You stand up and tell the court that you're going to call Chemos on rebuttal after Edgley testifies. I said, that way, you will, and at this point, by the way, the government was very concerned about their case, whether they were going to win the case. They had even offered Edgley a manslaughter conviction in place of first-degree murder. Now, if you knew the ins and outs of criminal law and the way these people operate, it gets very involved, but it was a great offer for Edgley. He turned it down. He got on the witness stand, and I said, the key to examining George Edgley is keep him on the witness stand. Let him talk and talk and talk, and he'll hang himself. Prosecutor kept him up there for 10 days. jury came in, first-degree murder. And he's in state prison for life because of it. Now, I'm not even sure what the declaration says, but I can tell you this. George Edgley does not like Michael Flynn. George Edgley has never had any association or affiliation with me of any nature or description other than me being like opposing counsel. Next part of the story. Now, this is going to get a little bit involved. But it will answer, I think it'll answer a lot of questions. And I think, you know, people need to know this, to know what's going on in this litigation. Now, in the summer of 1984, after the Armstrong trial, the church on July 23rd releases the Tamimi affidavit saying I forged a $2 million check of L. Ron Hubbard, for which he was paid $25,000 to do so. Now, I don't know Tamimi from Adam, and I never have, and the thing is ridiculous. Now, Ingram is the one who procured the affidavit, which Tamimi has since repudiated. He says, Ingram did it. He paid me to do it. It's all nonsense. In fact, there's all kinds of witnesses now that there's a grand jury going on in Boston in connection with this frame above me. The reason Edgley becomes important is as follows. At some point, prior to the summer of 1984 and continuing up to the present time, Eugene Ingram and other private investigators, including Harvey Brower, who has since been disbarred, who is now working for Ingram, went to mobsters, murderers, con men, liars, perverts, thieves, everywhere, and paid them money to get declarations, such as the Edgley Declaration. How do I know this? There is a myriad of assorted circumstantial evidence which is too voluminous for me to go into. Suffice it to say at this point that there's a grand jury looking into everything I've just told you in connection with the attempt to frame me not only for the Tamimi thing but for the Edgley thing. So just think of this for a minute. I was number one in my class in law school. I'm married with three children. I have never had any other than traffic, speeding violations, any problem of any nature or description with the law. I have never had any problems with the Bar Association until the Church of Scientology. I've never had any problems, and I had a tremendous reputation. I have the highest average in the history of my law school. Eugene Ingram is running around Boston paying George Edgley's, a la Tamimi's, huge sums of money to say that I am the biggest drug dealer in the United States. Forging $2 million checks, a known mobster. I mean, it's just patently ridiculous. And people who are in the Church of Scientology, for whom I'm now speaking, have got to understand, along the lines of the, as I was telling Eddie Walters, the poem If by Rudyard Kipling. If you can watch the truth you've spoken twisted by knaves to set a trap for fools. Well, that's what they've done with this Black PR pack. And the people in the church who could believe this are being seriously victimized to believe this type of nonsense. But in any event, they went to a mobster named George Cater. Ingram did. Ingram or Brower, or both, at different times. And they offered Cater $100,000 to implicate me. And I don't know this guy Cater from Adam. Cater took... They offered him $33,000 down, which he took. This is church money, by the way, that we're talking about for all of these things. They offered him $33,000 down, which Cater took. Then, and I'm unclear on this, either Cater waffled on what he was supposed to do or didn't deliver the things that he was supposed to deliver, because what happened next is Cater demanded the 67,000 additional. Ingram said, not until you deliver. Cater got in a fight with Ingram over the 67,000. Cater apparently is a real monster. Threatened to kill Ingram. Ingram then, apparently out of fear for his life or something, went to some government agency. Like, can you believe that? And claimed that he had been threatened by Cater. So now there's going to be an indictment in connection with this bribery, extortion. I mean, it's birds of a feather flock together. I mean, it's like the Shanahan, Golson, Edgley thing. It's just absurd. Now, so that's going to be coming down. And whatever ramifications, I don't know. What I just told you about is what I know so far. FBI tape recorded. All these subsequent conversations where Ingram offered money. That will be coming out. Now, to me, from what we know, and I've heard two stories in this, I know he was paid $25,000 of church money. And he's currently under indictment and wasn't under indictment then for perjury. So when Ingram paid the $25,000, he knew that he was dealing with a known international con man who was currently wanted in it's either Venezuela or it's a South American country, the United Arab Emirates, West Germany, the United States, and Aruba. He's wanted in all those countries for major cons and scams. Ingram, when he pays the $25,000, knows what I just told you. So use your common sense. You've got this church investigator, Eugene Ingram, who's been removed from the LAPD for pimping, pandering, running a house of prostitution, etc., which we're going to get into, paying $25,000 to the collection of characters I've just described to implicate the arch enemy of Scientology in forging a $2 million check of L. Ron Hubbard? I mean, any person of any common sense would come to understand that the level of the international management of the church that would be doing this has got some serious problems. They're paying L. Ron's money away to an indicted perjurer to say that this lawyer, it's just absurd in any event. He promised two stories. One story is he promised him $100,000. Another story is he promised, well, actually there's three, because I also heard from another source he promised $200,000. I've heard he was promised $800,000 on conviction. Within a month after July 23rd, 1984, when they released this whole Tamimi thing to the public, and they traveled to all the major cities in the United States saying Michael Flynn did it, and Ala Tamimi, and they held this major dog and pony show, saying that I'm the culprit. They were on a radio station in Boston saying I was going to be indicted in 30 days, and Heber Gentz was on with Ingram, et cetera, et cetera. Now, they knew, Ingram knew, that he had to cough up more money for Tamimi. Of course, Michael Flynn has not been indicted. And it's now almost 2 years later. In fact, there's a grand jury going on investigating the frame-up for me. And I know that other witnesses who have been called, who were involved in the scam, have also turned state's evidence and said the whole thing is a setup. Tamimi now is sitting over. So Tamimi flees the United States. He's under indictment. He runs. Jumps bail. He's caught in Italy for passing a bad check. Then they realize that, all these countries are after him, so they put him in jail. He sits in the can for a bad check wrap and awaiting extradition to the United States for almost 2 years now. When, this bad check thing he could do his 30 or 60 days and be out. But the extradition proceeding is the kicker. So he's sitting there. He's got his $25,000. Nothing is happening. Now, I have never talked to Al At-Tamimi in my life, and I signed an affidavit in this, and I got to try to remember the dates. It's either March or April of 85. I get, and I'll never forget this, it's sent to my home. I get this handwritten note, and it basically says, he's got the full, it's from Tamimi. He says, here's the full story. The thing was all set up by Ingram. It's all broken English. It was set up by Ingram, and it's been filed in cases all over the United States, this thing from Tamimi. So then I contact my lawyer, and my lawyer sends a telegram to Tamimi saying, okay, if you sign the enclosed affidavit saying that Michael Flynn had nothing to do with it, and then we'll come over and see you. I mean, this guy's just a con man. We're reluctant to even get near this guy. So just sign this enclosed affidavit, which is like two paragraphs, saying the whole thing's a fabrication, and you know it, and blah, blah, blah. Tamimi, while this is going that to Italy, Tamimi sends me a telegram, all of which are on the court records now, basically saying, waiting to hear from you. I then send a telegram saying, or my lawyer does, there's an affidavit, a letter on the way. Do you acknowledge that the declaration is false? This is a key evidentiary point that's going to come up in the case. So Mimi sends a telegram back saying the declaration is false. Okay? Subsequently, Tamimi gets extradited first to Germany, where he is right now. And we're waiting for him to be extradited to the United States. Now, I suppose I should sum up this whole area by saying that, you know, obviously I didn't forge L. Ron Hubbard's check. I mean, I don't know these characters from Adam. It's obvious to anyone who looks into all the facts, some of which I've described to you, that that's the case. My lawyer in California here recently suggested the following to me. He says, they're now offering, and recently they've had advertisements in several Boston newspapers implicating the United States attorney, assistant United States attorneys, the FBI, in a conspiracy to cover up the whole thing because they're convening a grand jury which is designed to show that they tried to frame me rather than I did it. So now all these other FBI agents and the government and the U.S. attorney in Boston are also in on it. Now, my lawyer says to me what I should do, since I now know all these facts, in light of the reward that is being offered, is put all the facts together, send them to Ingram, and demand the $100,000 reward on the basis that I know that Tamimi did it and Rezovic. But in any event, in connection with this whole thing, I have sued the following. I have two basic lawsuits. I have one for all of the things that were done up to 1983, which involves numerous lawsuits, harassment, theft of documents from my office, et cetera, et cetera. And then a lawsuit that was brought in the whole check cycle. The lawsuit is pending in California, and I have sued David Miscavige, Eugene Ingram, Freedom Magazine, Author Services, Inc., and Church of Scientology International. The complaint is shortly to be amended to include John Peterson and maybe one or two other people. I believe there'll be a trial within the next year on this whole thing. Everything I've told you will be borne out, and that's the end of that one.